Welcome to our guest, Stephen Huff. Pleasure
Hello.
To have you with us.
It's nice to be here.
And we've been listening to your CDs for so many years, and there are so many of them. So now here you are. You're actually a person. We sometimes forget that, you know. We sometimes think CDs are just kind of all there is there. You've been in this country for a while now, performing, I guess.
Yeah, well, I've lived in America for 23 years now, although not all of the time.
So that's why you want the dollar to get stronger.
Well, it just depends where you are at the time, doesn't it? But now I studied here for a couple of years in the early 80s, and I basically have the same apartment I had as a student. It has been decorated, but not much has changed. So I keep that as my base when I'm here. And I'm here probably about 3 months of the year playing concerts now, which I love coming. I mean, I'm just thinking about this thumb drive. What a marvelous thing it is when the people listening to something actually have a part in making it happen. You know, this doesn't happen in Europe, and people look admiringly at what happens in America, that you have this kind of connection, because in some countries you'll just have either government funding or some kind of large corporate thing. But the sense that you can give $10 a month and actually, therefore, in a small but vital way, support something like this is really quite wonderful.
You're in town not just to
help us with
which actually you've done. I should add that Stephen Huff is doing that on his own. We didn't ask him to do any kind of pledge breaks with us or anything, but it's great to hear that honest, sincere support. You're actually in Wisconsin to play the Saint-Saëns' fourth concerto with the Madison Symphony tonight, tomorrow night, and Sunday afternoon.
Yeah. In your marvelous new hall here, which was not here when I last came. I mean, that's another extraordinary thing. You know, in London at the moment, the South Bank Centre, which was built after the Second World War, has always been an architectural disaster, I think, by most people's thoughts. But also acoustically leaves an awful lot to be desired. So basically the festival hall is being reworked now. No one quite knows how much is going to be done. They can't touch it because it's a monument to the ugliness of the 1950s. And it's protected amazingly as such.
In London, who would have thought that something in the 1950s would be considered historical?
There we are. But, you know, to be able, I know that someone made an extraordinarily generous donation for the concert hall here, and that we just don't have that sort of generosity. And that's the other end of the scale from the $10 a month that we were talking about before. And so I don't know how the festival hall will be, but what a pity, really, for us that you know, London doesn't really have one, gosh, I'm going to get in awful trouble for this, aren't I, but one great concert hall. Because unfortunately, most of them were built before the more recent discoveries, if you like, of acoustical science, or rediscoveries of what the 19th century people seem to know much better than the early 20th century or mid 20th century people.
So there are some that look really beautiful, perhaps, but the sound just doesn't work that well.
Well, not even that look particularly beautiful. We had a great hall. It's actually a rather interesting political story. I mean, this has nothing to do with Saint-Saëns or the concert tonight, but it is interesting. The Queen's Hall was bombed in 1940 and was badly damaged, but not destroyed. But after the war, the political powers that be decided that they wanted a new art centre on the South Bank, and so they tore down what was one of the greatest halls in Europe because they'd made this political decision to build what became the Festival Hall and so on. The Queen's Hall could easily have been repaired, and today it would have been unthinkable to tear down a great Victorian hall, which with so many historical things, but unfortunately, all that is left is a tiny little part of the stage door around the back of an ugly modern hotel, and the shape of the pavement of the sidewalk, and it's actually shaped in a big circle, and you think, well, why would it be circular? And that was the shape of the old Queen's Hall. So if you go to London, it's right in the centre, just near Oxford Street, where it used to be, and, you know, Tchaikovsky was there, and Rachmaninoff, and all the great people played there. So it's one of those sort of sad things when politics takes over and has made a decision and nothing can turn it back.
Well, I think we should go, Vicky, and check that out.
I think that would be a good idea.
It was a very interesting documentary, actually, on the BBC about the Queen's Hall. Many early recordings were actually made there as well. And the proms, the concerts that are now at the Albert Hall, used to be at the Queen's Hall. So it has an interesting history.
Should we hear?
I was just going to ask. We have a stack of your recordings. You've recorded many, many CDs. And I think you identified actually a piece that I just played yesterday.
Oh.
On this very album.
No. Is that? Well, no. I think it bears repeating.
All right.
Sure.
It was a wonderful performance. It's from the Stephen Huff Piano Collection on Hyperion. And it's the Chopin Ballade No. 3 in A flat.
So you hadn't heard that since you recorded it? That was a while ago, too, wasn't it? A
couple of years now, yes. I don't like listening to my own recordings, really. Well, for all sorts of reasons. You sort of do them, and of course, once it's out, there's nothing you can do if you don't like something. Sometimes you do like something and think, gosh, I don't think I can play like that anymore. But we were just talking a little bit about the cover of this CD. This is a collection of one track from every solo record I've made for the Hyperion label. It's called the Stephen Huff Piano Collection. Is that what it's called? Piano Collection? Yeah.
Yes.
But the cover of it is a painting, an extraordinary painting, by a friend of mine, Anthony Mastromateo, who's an American artist who lives near Cleveland. And as we're doing a lot of plugging of different things today, I'm going to say that his show in San Francisco opens at the gallery called After Modern. And in fact, you can get details of this on the web at aftermodern.com. And I think it's running for a month. But you'll see on there a selection, I think, from next week. I don't think it's fully up the site yet. Of his amazing paintings, including one which will be on my next CD, which is a collection of Spanish music, and it's a painting called Gazpacho.
As in soup.
Mm-hmm. And it's tomatoes done with extraordinary realism. So you'll see that sleeve before anyone else does on the web, I think, from next week, aftermodern.com.
Wow, the web certainly has changed the way we, get new releases and how things spread around musically.
Well, even changed the way people edit records, because you can now email a cut from a record to someone. Mm. They can listen to it and say, that's fine, email it back and say, use it. So, you can even edit on the web or via email, which is an amazing thought, isn't it?
It is.
Not that many years when you couldn't edit at all.
What's amazing to me is the breadth of the music that you find to play. I know a few years ago you issued a CD of music by York Bowen, and who had heard of that composer before that CD?
Right. I think it's the piano has more written for it than all the other instruments put together, and probably times by 10. There's a vast amount out there, and I think it's always interesting to try and find something that's not been recorded before that's good. Mm-hmm. There's an awful lot that's not worth recording and playing. But York Bowen was an interesting character. He was called the English Rachmaninoff, and his music's very romantic and lush. And really, there was very little recorded. He was actually... He died the day before I was born, I discovered later, which was kind of a curious fact. But really a wonderful craftsman, and apparently a very fine pianist himself.
Now you do some arranging too.
Yes, and composing. I've done quite a lot of that over the years. I find it, I love doing it. But I think what you're going to play next is a very light-hearted thing that I wrote as encore that I thought would make people smile. It's actually a sort of concert transcription of the song My Favorite Things by Richard Rodgers from The Sound of Music.
So My Favorite Things by Richard Rodgers via Stephen Huff, arranger and performer there. And I was noticing that the first CD we played was recorded in Henry Wood Hall, I believe.
Yes.
And I was wondering where other CDs are recorded, where else you record?
Well, the last one you just heard was actually recorded at the 92nd Street Y in New York City.
That's been done in the 80s.
Quite an old record. I've recorded a lot in Henry Wood Hall and also in Bristol. There's also a sort of ex-church, as it were, St. George's, Bristol, Brandon Hill. You know, there are a number of considerations with recording classical music. It's best to have a natural acoustic to work with. With pop music, you want no acoustic and then everything's manipulated.
Right.
But with classical music, we're looking for natural. You know, it's the sort of organic form of music. The instrument is rarely a microphone. Everything is just there. I mean, the piano is made of entirely natural. It's totally biodegradable. If you left a piano in a field for 100 years, it probably would just be dust at the end. So that's important. The other thing, of course, is keeping out outside noise, because music, classical music, explores a lot of very, very soft colors. So even some plane in the sky or a dog barking or a car alarm, all of those things make a recording impossible to release. So the thing with St. George's in Bristol is it's triple glazed, and it's also quite a quiet part of the town as well. So those are considerations.
Mm-hmm. Then the other alternative is just to play loud.
Not a good idea, though. I don't think that's the...
Well, there's the other aspect of it, too, in recording, where you tend to maybe you don't, but some tend to over-prepare, and then you perhaps lose the daring quality of a piece or the music.
Yes, it's interesting. There are no rules about it, really. It's a very different thing from a concert. Mm-hmm. And I think of it really as a concert is like a play and a recording is like a movie. And what matters at the end of the day is the quality of the movie. Now, you know, if a scene in a movie is recorded 10 times and then you get a great scene, then I'm not going to say, oh, what a pity you couldn't do it in 5. The point is that sometimes the creative process is actually in doing something again and again until you, not until you get it right, but until you get the frisson or the sparkle in a performance. And I remember watching a documentary about The Shining, you know, I've forgotten the name of the very famous
Stephen King.
Kubrick.
And Kubrick, yeah.
Yeah, Stanley Kubrick. And how creative he was. I imagine with a movie like that, the script would have been written months before, everything mapped out, and then they did it. But no, here he is, actually, as they're shooting it, saying, oh, no, it'd be much better if you're over in that side of the room, or say these words instead. And he's actually... It was an energetically creative process, in a way, really, that often recordings are. I can do a take and listen and then think of something totally different that I never thought about in the piece before and go back and try it 10 times. And then you build up a certain excitement. Mm-hmm. And this is very important when recording with orchestras, because what happens in a recording is you go through a movement, people are kind of on, but there are things you want to change. And by the time you've gone through it a few times, people are getting tired. And it starts to sound accurate but lackluster. Uh-huh. So how do you inject a kind of energy into people? And I remember recording the Shevchenko Fourth Concerto in the last movement. I got the orchestra, we just went through that movement about 7 times, and each time a little bit faster than the time before. And they were just, we got to a pitch of a sort of frenzy. But then finally we started to get something that you get in a concert performance. Because you can't just sit down at 10:30 on a Monday morning and give a great performance. It just isn't in us. We have to build up to it. And in fact, in the same documentary about The Shining, Jack Nicholson trying to get himself into a manic mood to play this psychopathic character. Again, you don't just turn this on. It you have to build up to it. And so that's something of the quality, I think, of making a record.
Sort of implies that you play the crowd a little bit too, though, doesn't it? I mean, in a concert.
Well, you're inspired by the crowd. There's a danger element that you can't stop once you start, which you don't have in the recording studio. And also, it's a particular time at night, and you know, and the orchestra tune, and then you walk onto the stage and there's applause. It sets up a situation where you're going to be able to be more on than you are just at home. Just like adrenaline. I mean, adrenaline works either well or badly, doesn't it? If someone's actually good, say, at speaking in public, the adrenaline will make them better. Uh-huh. If they're not good at speaking in public, it'll make them jittery and they won't even be able to say a word. So,
Now, I know that you've recorded all five of the Saint-Saëns piano concertos.
Yeah.
The fourth I've heard described as more grand than the others. How would you characterize
this
fourth?
I think it's the most symphonic in a way. It's a big journey from the material for the pieces is sort of the same from beginning to end, but it goes through all these amazing transformations. It begins rather seriously and ends with, I think, some of the most joyful music I know written by anyone. The whole last section, it's in C major, which is already the purest, brightest key. And I've never played this piece without feeling a real thrill as the orchestra, you know, they all play at the full force and the pianist playing at the full force. Lots of virtuosity. It's a very difficult piece to play for the pianist. But it's a tremendous journey from the minor in the beginning to the major at the end, and a very satisfying piece, I think.
Well, shall we have a little Americana to get us to the quiz question then?
All right.
From our guest,
right.
Stephen Huff, right. In the form of some McDowell.
I'll quickly mention the concerts that you're playing with the Madison Symphony Orchestra tonight at 7:30, tomorrow night at 8, and Sunday afternoon at 2:30. And in addition to the Saint-Saëns Concerto, number 4, there's the Unfinished Symphony and the Firebird Suite by Stravinsky.
Yes.
Big concert.
Wonderful conclusion to the Madison Symphony Orchestra season.
This is Stephen Huff with the Hexentents. There's a composer who, by his own account, found it easier to play fast than slowly. He actually was afraid at times that his hands would run away with him, Edward McDowell.
And that was his Hexentents.
Played by our guest, Stephen Huff, which puts us at 12:35 and time for the 12:30 plus 5 quiz question.
First, our thanks to Stephen Huff for being here and spending some time with us.
I've enjoyed this, and thank you for everyone for their generosity of, of donating. I've been watching the screen going up, so I hope that people will still continue to give to this marvelous resource that you have here.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
1-800-383-9772.
Thank you very
much. That's wonderful spontaneity.
How could you resist that?
Yeah, that was also unexpected, but much appreciated.